6 weeks ago, you might have seen this in the news, in the sports section. There was an old New York Met who died, Bud Harrelson. He was played for the Mets in the 60s and 70s, and then he coached and managed in the, I guess, the late 80s and the early 90s. And he played on some great teams. That's actually saying a lot, because the Mets didn't really have a lot of great teams over the years. But when they were good, he always seemed to be there. 1969, when they won the World Series. 73, they were in the World Series. 1986, he was coaching when they won the World Series. And he wasn't even really a great player. He was a pretty good fielder, but definitely a fan favorite. When he died, a friend of mine sent me a video, and it was pretty interesting. It was a video, a conversation with Buddy Harrelson and his teammates, or a couple of them, from that 1969 championship season. Tom Seaver was part of it. Ed Cranepool, Tug McGraw. Anyway, in the course of this conversation, Buddy Harrelson told the story about this moment. This moment during that great season. And that it impacted what the team did. You know, the Mets, again, I think is, if you're a fan, you certainly know this. Even from a distance, you probably do. Like, the Mets were historically bad. Like, biblically bad in the early 60s. They set records for bad that have never been broken. They began in 1962, and they lost 120 of the 160 games that they played. That's like remarkably bad. This went on for years, about 5 or 6 years. 6 years after then, I think it was, or maybe 5 years after that, they lost 100 games in 1967, so they were a little bit better than in the beginning, but they were just beyond awful. 1968, they get a new manager, this guy Gil Hodges, who was himself was a pretty great baseball player. He played for the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 40s and 50s. And slowly started to turn the team around. 68 was still not a great year, but better than the previous seasons. But 69 was when things began to change. They were playing 500 ball, which was kind of like unimaginable when you consider their history. They had an amazing pitching staff that was really what was carrying them. Hall of Fame pitching staff. Anyway, it was probably two-thirds through this season. And again, they're playing 500 ball. And in this interview, they talked about this particular game, this moment. They lost this game, which they shouldn't have lost. They were winning up until the ninth inning. Real sloppy play, and they lost the game. They gave it away. They come back to the locker room, and they were explaining this, Bud Harrelson, how they were, you know, they were upset by the game, that loss, but they were playing 500 ball, so they thought they were kind of on top of the world. And they weren't really that upset about this tough loss. Now, Gil Hodges, the manager, came into the locker room, and he's watching them kind of indifferent to this loss. And he said he picked up a bench. He said it was like a picnic table bench. It was heavy. And he threw it across the room, smashed against the wall. And they were stunned. They couldn't believe what this guy had done. It was so out of character. He was a very stoic, kind of quiet, very calm guy. He said, Harrelson said, or Tug McGraw actually in the interview said they were like cowering in the corner. They just were like frightened by this moment. And then Hodges said to them something to the effect of, you guys have become comfortable being average. Yeah, and I know 500 ball for the Mets prior to the season was like kind of amazing. But he was like, you're way more than 500 players, 500 win-loss. He said, I'm not accepting average. I'm not accepting average. This is not who you are. And he let them know it. There was 60 games left in the season at that point. They won 45 out of the 60 games and beat the Orioles, one of the great teams ever. Beat them in 5 games in the World Series. This is not who you are. You are capable of so much more. And they all agreed in this interview that that moment was this turnaround. And I read somewhere where somebody said that people are measured by what angers them. I thought that was kind of an interesting thought. People are measured by what angers them. You can tell something about a person by what really ticks them off. What makes you angry? And I don't mean like lose your patience, losing your temper in traffic. I'm not talking about, you know, lacking patience with the kids. Hey, we all those things happen here and there. I'm talking about like anger from the gut. What doesn't make you angry, but should? It's another interesting question. Are there things that really should be upsetting us, and for whatever reason, we've kind of don't seem to get upset about it anymore? You know, what made Gil Hodges angry was this is not who you are. Like, you are capable of so much more. I mean, isn't that, or some version of that, what makes Jesus angry in this gospel? Hey, it's not a locker room bench, but it's a table in the temple. This temple that's been turned into a flea market, essentially. And he's not having it. And he's going to let him know. And he does. It's like this, look at what you've become. Look what we've let this place turn into. This is not who we are. What we have turned into or allowed this place to become is not okay. That's what Gil Hodges was saying in Shea Stadium that season, and that's what Jesus was saying in his temple. You know, I think maybe more important than the why is the fact that he did. Not so much why he got angry, but the fact that he got angry. Jesus got angry. And if he did, then there must be a place for it. And I'm not saying that's a green light to just lose your mind on a regular basis and just blow gaskets every time stuff happens. But I am saying this, because he got angry. Sometimes anger's okay. When is anger okay? When is anger maybe even good? God is good, and God got angry. So I guess there's some place at certain times for anger. What makes you angry? You remember, some of you I suspect remember in the news, this was about, I think about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. Down in Virginia, I think it was Northern Virginia, there was a father and he was speaking at a school board meeting. His daughter had been assaulted by another kid. It was by a boy who was now saying he was a girl. And because of the transgender craziness that the schools have surrendered to, this kid was allowed to be in a girl's bathroom. And he assaulted his daughter. They moved the kid to another school, and he did it again. So the father is raging against what's happened and the fact that they're not listening to him. It's like the church scandal. Moving people, pretending that things aren't happening. Well, they were big time pretending. And in this moment, he got arrested. This like terrible video of him. He's on the ground. It's like four cops trying to like subdue him and probably handcuff him. And the more it goes on, the crazier it becomes. They say in that moment, it was almost like the birth of this parents' rights movement that's happened in the schools since COVID. Because with COVID, parents really for the first time were getting a real sense of what their kids were being taught, the books they were reading, the curriculum. And you get in this crazy stuff. Topics being discussed in third grade. It's like, are you kidding? Stuff that should never be talked about in school being told to first graders. And it's parents saying, enough. Parents basically throw on the bench against the locker room wall. The parents saying, flipping the tables over in the temple saying, this can't continue. You're not gonna steal the innocence of my kids. Hey, thank God for our Catholic school and what the schools are about. Man, maybe if there was ever a time if it's possible for parents with little kids to consider a Catholic school, I can't imagine a time where the need might be greater, where innocence is protected and truth is taught, where we're not afraid to say, no, that's not true, and that's not okay, and we're not gonna sign off on this. Could you blame that father? I think everybody was with him. Eventually he got pardoned by the governor, thankfully. But it's like things have gone sideways. It's like you get a snow day, the kids get a snow day, and parents' heads explode because they find out the textbook that the kid is reading and what's being communicated in these books. Gender ideology stuff, anti-police comments, anti-American stuff. What? Who's behind this? Isn't it time to get angry? Isn't it overtime, maybe, to get angry if we haven't? That was the question I asked before. What makes you angry, and what doesn't, but should? Shouldn't the likes of some of that make us angry? I mean, ultimately, like the first reading this morning, it's the Ten Commandments, of course. These 10 rules from God for us. It's really, in some respects, if you look at the first one, and if we nail the first commandment, I am God, don't have any other gods, I'm the only one. If we wrap our hearts around that and commit to that, everything else kind of is gonna follow out appropriately. Hey, if I make God number one, I'm gonna respect my parents. I'm not gonna be killing and murdering. I'm not gonna be adulterous. I'm not gonna be bearing false witness. Because I'm following God's truth. If I make him number one, but if I don't, if I make something or someone else number one, that's when things go sideways. That's when these distorted ideologies become curriculum. Hey, it's like the, you know, like the golf jokes. Like the guys who are just like so obsessed with golf, it's like, that's the first commandment for these guys. It's sort of like golf first and everything else second. It's the four guys who play golf faithfully every Saturday morning. Rain or shine, they've been doing this for years. One day they're playing, they're at the green, this guy's getting ready to putt. He looks up and in the distance he sees a funeral procession. The hearse and a bunch of cars behind it, and he sees it and he stops. And he takes off his hat and he bows his head and he absolutely waits for the procession to pass by. And the other three are looking at this and they're like surprised and impressed. When the hearse pulls away, the guys go say to him, "Man, that was very respectful." And the guy goes, "Well, I mean, we were married for 43 years. Like, I mean, it's ridiculous, right? Like, okay, nobody's going to do that. But like when we take something and we make it way more important than it ever should be. And I'm not really talking about golf. I'm talking about bigger stuff. And when that gets distorted, and that gets thrust upon our kids, man, you bet we should be angry. Too much has been compromised. Too much has been reimagined. And we are being told culturally to just be quiet and accept it. And I think this gospel this morning gives us license to say, no. Some things are not okay. Some things are never true. And I reserve the right to express that. And I will act on my right to protect my kids from it. You know, that manager of the Mets, he said, "You've all become too comfortable with average," because they were previously so lame, playing 500 ball was kind of reason to celebrate. This guy said, "No, it's not, because you're capable of more. You are more than average. Don't accept average."